Welcome to the MJA podcast. I'm talking today to Dr. Michael Lowe, who is a haematologist at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research and also at Monash Health. Hello, Michael. Thank you for your time today.
No problems at all.
You've co-authored a narrative review for the MJA on iron deficiency. What's the prevalence of iron deficiency anemia in Australia?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting and difficult question to answer. Even though nutrition levels have gone up significantly in Australia, we know that iron deficiency still remains very prevalent. Our best estimates are that around 12% of females of menstruating age will be iron deficient. And a recent survey of Australia suggested that around 3% of Australia's population were anemic, with about two-thirds of that due to iron deficiency anemia. We therefore estimate that approximately 250,000 Australians are living with iron deficiency anemia, and a significantly larger proportion will have iron deficiency without anemia, although the absolute numbers are very difficult to be sure of.
Let's talk about the consequences of that. If kids have IDA, what are the consequences for them?
The consequences of iron deficiency can be quite severe. And the big issue for young children is their cognitive development and the cognitive impacts of being iron deficient. And there's a lot of data that suggests that iron deficiency or iron deficient anemia can impair cognition and behaviour in young children.
Because of fatigue, or is there some other mechanism happening there?
Oh, so we think that there are a number of reasons why children would have these behavioural and cognitive issues. Obviously, fatigue from being possibly anemic is a significant issue, but we do think that there's a primary role for iron in terms of cognition, and there is growing evidence that iron plays a critical role in neurotransmitters and the balance of neurotransmitters.
That makes sense. What about for adults? What are the consequences there?
Yeah, so there's similar things to children, so cognition, but also exercise performance, fatigue, and then the really high risk is obviously pregnant mothers.
Yes.
So the risk for pregnant mothers is association with iron deficiency anemia, with low birth weight of their babies, prematurity, and also maternal morbidity associated with complications during the delivery.
What about Indigenous people? Is there a higher prevalence amongst them?
Yeah, so the highest rates of iron deficiency anemia are seen in premenopausal women, those that are socially disadvantaged, and those of Indigenous background.
Right.
And there's numerous reasons why Indigenous people would have higher rates of iron deficiency, including education, nutrition, as well as access to health services. So there's lots of reasons why people of Indigenous background would be at higher risk.
Why is iron deficiency so hard to diagnose?
The issue with iron deficiency is that we don't have a single test which clearly differentiates whether someone's iron deficient or not.
Right.
If someone is having is being worked up for iron deficiency, they would standardly have a full blood examination, which includes your hemoglobin levels, and a number of other parameters, including your mean core muscular volume, or MCV. They also would have an iron studies performed, which, depending on the lab, may comprise of a number of different parameters, but would classically include either a serum or plasma iron, transferrin saturation, transferrin levels, and ferritin. Now, the issue is that whilst the most reliable marker within that group is the ferritin level, that can also be confounded by other diseases such as inflammation, which can make the ferritin artificially high. And what we do recommend to everyone who is trying to investigate someone with a possible iron deficiency is you don't look at any individual value, but look at the overall picture, as there are patterns within the iron studies which would give an idea of whether someone is likely to be iron deficient or not. It needs to be taken in the context of the patient in terms of whether they're unwell at the time, as well as the overall picture rather than the individual value.
Where does a bone marrow biopsy fit into all of that?
It's always been taught, well, it's commonly taught that that a bone marrow biopsy is the gold standard for diagnosing iron deficiency and iron deficiency anemia. But we don't actually recommend that patients actually have a bone marrow biopsy if there's any concerns about iron deficiency. The reason is that, that you can actually often perform the serum testing and can often work out whether a patient's iron deficient from the serum testing. It's also possible that if inflammation may be contributing to the high ferritin in the setting of all the other parameters suggesting iron deficiency, you can also do something called a soluble transferrin receptor assay, which is only raised in the presence of iron deficiency. It won't be raised if there's only inflammation going on. So it helps us differentiate between those that have may have inflammation but are also iron deficient at the time, or whether they just have inflammation. The role for a bone marrow biopsy, we don't feel is warranted because it can be quite a painful procedure, and it can have complications. If there's any concerns, it's not unreasonable, and certainly in our practice, we do sometimes prescribe oral iron replacement and then monitor the patient to see if they have an improvement in the hemoglobin and iron studies rather than doing a bone marrow. Now, we do recommend that if a patient's having a bone marrow for another reason, so sometimes they'll be investigated for other cytopenias, that Pearl's Prussian blue stain should be performed to assess the iron status within the bone marrow. But we don't recommend people have that just as a routine for investigation.
Right. Which brings us to treatment. Talk to me about the differences between oral and IV treatment for iron. When should you use one or the other, or can you use both anytime?
As you alluded to, there are two broad ways of replacing iron. This first is oral, and the other second is intravenous. We do recommend that patients should be commenced on oral as a first line of treatment. There are a number of reasons why we recommend that. Firstly, there's a lot of data on the safety of oral iron, it is a much more cost-effective. There is issues, obviously, with side effects of oral iron. So in trials, we know that patients with oral iron are twice as likely to report gastrointestinal upset, either diarrhea or constipation, or changing stool colours than those who had either placebo or control. Nevertheless, we do recommend that as a first-line intervention for iron deficiency or iron deficiency anemia, patients should be offered about 30 to 100 milligrams of elemental iron.
Yep.
And the complicating factor of that is that often on the prescription, it'll actually say the amount of the iron compound. So they might say 325 milligrams of ferrous sulfate, which contains 100 milligrams of elemental iron.
Right.
And so you do need to actually look at the elemental iron makeup of the compound that you're prescribing.
What does the evidence say about including vitamin C in the mix?
There is a number of studies which suggest that a number of compounds can either increase the absorption of iron in the gut, such as vitamin C, or inhibit the absorption of iron in the gut, such as tea can actually reduce the amount of iron absorbed.
Right.
So there is theoretical evidence that those things could, so adding vitamin C could be of benefit. However, when the phase 3 trials have been performed, there isn't a clear obvious benefit in terms of increasing your hemoglobin levels or iron status. That's not to say that it wouldn't necessarily be beneficial, but we don't necessarily recommend the addition of vitamin C as a routine in terms of iron replacement, but it certainly is unlikely to do any harm.
So at what point do you go, okay, oral's not doing enough, let's switch them to IV?
The role for intravenous iron is really for those that either can't tolerate oral iron, and so people that have severe gastrointestinal side effects, patients that we know are unlikely to be able to absorb the iron, patients with gastrointestinal illnesses such as uncontrolled inflammatory bowel disease, or who've had significant gastrointestinal surgery, or those that are severely anemic. And we define it according to WHO parameters, so a hemoglobin of less than 80. We do, in our practice, recommend considering intravenous iron. And the reason for that is there is some weak evidence that suggests that giving intravenous iron will increase the hemoglobin faster than oral iron, may take a little bit longer to increase the hemoglobin. And at this level of below 80, we do feel that patients are likely to be symptomatic in terms of their fatigue and exercise performance and would benefit from a rapid correction of the hemoglobin.
And do you need repeat doses? What's the regime?
Yeah, so there are a number of different intravenous iron formulations available in Australia. Namely, there are three on the PBS: iron sucrose, iron polymaltose, and ferric carboxymaltose.
Yeah.
So they all have a different dosing schedule, but most people would have sufficient iron from a single dose. So, for example, the most common one that we use at the moment is ferric carboxymaltose.
Yep.
And at that stage, we can give up to a gram of iron intravenously over a slow push or a 15-minute infusion. And that is often enough for most patients. You can repeat the dose approximately a week later. The reason that we wait a week is to try and reduce the amount of free iron within the circulation to reduce the possible side effects from intravenous iron.
Yep.
If a patient It doesn't have any gastrointestinal side effects. We also do offer them oral iron as ongoing treatment for the iron deficiency if we're trying to make sure that they remain iron replete.
Leads us to the question of follow-up. Some people say, you know, it should be a longer period of time, 6 months or whatever. What's your recommendation based on the evidence?
That's also a really interesting question, and there's not good evidence about what follow-up timing should be observed in patients with iron deficiency or iron deficiency anemia. I think what's quite obvious is that you definitely need follow-up for these patients, and you need to monitor them to make sure they remain iron replete. In the clinical setting, it may very much depend on your access to outpatient clinics or GP practices and how often you can bring patients back in. But in our setting, if a patient has got severe iron deficiency and receives an iron infusion, we would usually get them back within 2 weeks to make sure they have a response in terms of the hemoglobin and their reticulocytes count, the reticulocytes of the immature red blood cells coming out of the bone marrow. And we expect a rapid increase in reticulocyte if they've had an adequate response. If they haven't had an adequate response, obviously they need further investigation as they're not responding to the iron.
Yeah.
In terms of patients that don't have mild or moderate iron deficiency, we try to see them around 3 to 6 months after they've had their iron replacement therapy to see if they've remained iron replete. And if they become iron deficient again despite iron replacement therapy, even if you feel that you know what the cause is, you really need to consider further investigation, including a colonoscopy and a gastroscopy to look for occult sources of bleeding in these patients. Even in, say, young young premenopausal women who may complain of menorrhagia, that doesn't mean they can't have a concomitant blood source loss within their gastrointestinal tract. And if they're not remaining iron replete, then they should certainly be investigated further. Like when you're treating a patient with iron deficiency, you need to think of three broad things. So you need to think about what the possible cause is and try to correct that. For the vast majority of people, particularly premenopausal women, it's going to be menorrhagia, and trying to discuss with them appropriate management of their menstrual bleeding losses is important. But there are a number of other causes which are outlined within the article. The second one is iron replacement, which we've just discussed. And the third one is obviously follow-up and making sure they remain iron replete. And we do recommend that all patients with iron deficiency should be followed up. Whilst we have our routine follow-up times, we don't feel that the evidence is strong enough that if individual clinicians felt like more close follow-up is warranted, that we certainly would we think that's justified in terms of seeing patients more often and monitoring them more closely.
Terrific.
One thing that I would like to raise is the use of blood transfusion in patients who are severely iron deficient.
Yep.
It certainly is something that has been practiced in the past, but it's important that clinicians understand the risk of doing blood transfusion. So we don't recommend red cell transfusions or transfusion of packed cells resuspended or packed red cells resuspended in just routine patients without evidence of organ damage and compromise. And what we mean by that is severe chest pain such as angina pectoris or cardiac failure. And the reason for that is that a unit of blood is estimated to contain around 200 milligrams of elemental iron, so it's not a huge amount. And by giving them multiple transfusions, you are exposing often young patients to the immunological and infectious risks associated with a blood transfusion. It's also expensive. If they're not compromised, we would recommend they get, as suggested before, intravenous infusion of iron followed by oral iron replacement therapies. That's something that we would like to really get out there to the community, is that we don't feel that blood transfusion should be used except for in very extreme circumstances.
Thanks, Michael, for your time. I appreciate it.
No problem at all.
Thank you.